Good morning, Children's Health Defense. Today is Wednesday, October 18th. I'm Mary Holland, President of Children's Health Defense. So excited to be here with you. So we've got a great lineup today talking about the really important case that Brooke Jackson has brought against Ventavia, Pfizer, and ICON. But before we bring on our guests to really explore in detail what's going on in this case and why it's important, I want to let you know that at the same time, we're actually running on CHDTV now a hearing in a subcommittee of the House of Representatives Oversight Committee. And that subcommittee is the Committee on the Coronavirus Pandemic. And they're talking about biosafety. And among the experts are people who have been working on, frankly, bioweapons research in the United States for a long time. And we're going to be unpacking that hearing on Saturday on Good Morning CHD. So you're not going to want to miss it. That episode is going to be with Sam Husseini and Alexis Bodden-Meyer, two people who've followed this issue incredibly closely. And I know I will be tuning in on Saturday to watch them explain to us in lay terms what the hearing really means, what was covered, what wasn't covered. But today, I am so excited to bring on Brooke Jackson, the primary plaintiff who brought this case against Ventavia, Pfizer, and ICON for their fraud and malfeasance in the clinical trials for the Pfizer vaccine. So, Brooke, welcome to you today.
Good morning, Mary. Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
I'm delighted to see you. So you and I had the pleasure of talking last August and telling us about what had happened, and we can go back to that. But I want you to first tell the audience a little bit about your background, that you've been working in clinical trial research for a long time, and what you saw, what made you become this plaintiff and sort of having this whole lawsuit basically take over your life for the last few years. Tell us what happened initially that made you sort of feel compelled to do what you've been doing.
Right. Thank you. Yeah, so I hate to say this because I feel like it ages me so much, but I've been in the clinical trial industry, clinical research for over 20 years now. I started out as a research coordinator, so collecting data from patients, moved quickly into a more leadership role as a clinical trial manager, and then into a director of operations role. And in September of 2020, into a regional director role at Ventavia Research Group. So my responsibility there was to basically manage the day-to-day of, you know, the research staff that were participating in Pfizer's clinical trial.
And what did you, so you'd been doing this for a while, expert in this area, Brooke. What did you see that made you uncomfortable with what was going on?
Oh, gosh, so much. You know, Mary, I've said, you know, forever that since day one, when I walked into the clinic, I recognized, you know, just things were not on the up and up in terms of the company and how they were managing the clinical trial. And I saw that really from day one. You know, when I think back and I the top five things that really come to my mind were, you know, first, the lack of informed consent. You know, that's always something that in every year when we do our research training that we're taught, and we just know that informed consent is the most important part of participating in a clinical trial and having a surgery, for example. So that was really the first thing that I noticed was a lack of informed consent. We weren't consenting patients properly. We weren't consenting patients at all. So that was really the first thing that I saw.
And I know you saw other things. And so you went to your bosses, right? You brought this to the attention of Ventavia, right?
Every day, you know, we had a morning meeting. So every day I was bringing this to the attention of the other leaders on my team. You know, there was the lack of informed consent. There was unblinding. There was not reporting the adverse events properly. We were mixing up lab samples. I mean, the better question is what was Ventavia doing correctly, which was nothing. And they just, they were sympathetic to what I was saying. They recognized their failures and promised me that they were going to hire more people and hire more experienced nurses. We didn't even have a registered nurse on staff to administer, for example, epinephrine if a patient had, you know, an anaphylactic type reaction. And that wouldn't have mattered anyways because we didn't even have epinephrine in our crash cart. I mean, there were just so many problems. So,
just to clarify, so Ventavia was a subcontractor for Pfizer, right? And you were in these, you were in Texas doing this. So Ventavia sort of said, yes, we'll do better, but it didn't get better, did it?
Never. No. At one point, I even had to recommend that they pause enrollment in the clinical trial, especially when the unblinding was discovered. So patients were blinded to whether they were getting the active drug or if they were getting placebo. And when I recognized that at that point, 1,500 of our patients had been potentially unblinded, I knew per Pfizer's protocol that we had to stop and inform them. And to my surprise, they actually stopped enrollment. But then right after they did that, I got a text message that was basically to lie to Pfizer that we'd never unblinded these patients. We were removing documents from patients' charts and shredding them so that they wouldn't find out that we'd actually unblinded all these patients.
So you eventually Brooke, go to the FDA, isn't that right? To the Food and Drug Administration about what you saw as severe problems in this process?
Yeah, I did, you know, and I recognized just through emails that I was receiving directly from Pfizer and, you know, the contract research organization that Pfizer delegated some of the responsibility to, which was ICON. Just reading through some of the emails that I was getting, I recognized, you know, there was just this obvious rush to get this vaccine study to meet the enrollment goals. But there was just something that was not right. It was just a gut feeling. And so on the 25th of September, I took that to the FDA and I got fired about 6 hours after I contacted the FDA.
That's extraordinary. And what did you feel when you were fired 6 hours after doing the right thing to go to the government and saying there was massive fraud?
I think at that point, Mary, I didn't realize, I'd obviously felt there was kind of a change in the way that Ventavia was seeing me. You know, my husband always tells me, you know, think back, Brooke, you were every day going to, you know, the leadership team, the owners of this company, and basically telling them that their baby was ugly. So that's how he kind of describes it. But I was telling them everything that they were doing wrong. And so when I went to the FDA, I just thought, you know, this was a coincidence. I probably was on my way out anyway. But it's just too much of a coincidence to, you know, have contacted them and 6 hours later to have been fired.
Wow. So what did you do next? You obviously decided to bring a lawsuit, which must have been a big and challenging decision to make, Brooke.
Well, at that point, that was in September. Really, after I was fired, I just took an opportunity to really pause and go through the evidence that I collected at my time at Ventavia, go through my emails, and I realized that this was a bigger problem than in just Pfizer's trial because we were participating in other clinical trials, other vaccine trials, RSV trials, pneumococcal vaccine trials, and everything looked exactly the same. So I just spent my time doing that. I'd hired an attorney to represent me in a wrongful termination lawsuit. So I was kind of pursuing that. But in December of 2020, when the emergency use authorization was given, I knew that Pfizer did not exclude the data from Ventavia just based on my knowledge of where we were with enrollment goals, et cetera. I knew they couldn't have enrolled, you know, an additional 2,000 patients in that short time frame. So at that point, when the emergency use authorization was given, I knew that I was going to file a lawsuit.
Great. And we're about, we'll talk to your attorneys, but as you've looked at this, Brooke, and I know you've had a long time to think about it, how do you understand this incredible malfeasance, this incredible level of negligence and lack of informed consent? How do you understand what happened? Was it just the rush to market for Pfizer? Was it bigger factors? How do you understand it at this point?
Oh, gosh, I feel differently on different days, you know, with the knowledge that I have, the knowledge that the United States government has. I feel like this is an effort between big pharma and big government. And that's a really personal thing to talk about. Because of my faith in either of them, you know, I come from a military family. I have such love for my country, and I feel betrayed in a lot of ways, especially knowing that they know that this product is dangerous and that it's hurting people. So that's a tough question, Mary.
Well, I think it's a tough question for all of us, Brooke. So you ultimately file a False Claims Act case against Ventavia and Pfizer and ICON, right? The clinical research organizations and the manufacturer. And you're working with two attorneys, Robert Barnes and Werner Mendenhall. And I'd love to welcome them to the conversation now. They've been co-counsel in your case. And there's been some significant changes in the last several months. And so maybe Robert or Werner, Robert, why don't you start us off? Give us the case that you filed and then give us an update on how that's changed over the last year or so.
Yeah, so when the case was originally filed by predecessor counsel, they raised the core aspects of what Brooke raised in the False Claims Act. We came in, and during that stage, it was sealed. We came in, it was unsealed. There was some effort by the government to delay the publication of that suit for whatever motivation the government may have had, but they said it was to investigate the case. It's not apparent that they necessarily did that. Brooke wanted to make sure the public became aware of the case so that we could get it unsealed for that purpose, because at that time they were extending and expanding the COVID vaccine that she knew was dangerous from her own experience in the clinical trials to young children. And so we were able to unseal the case and they get the more of the public educated. And thanks to Brooke's efforts, ultimately most children did not take the COVID vaccine and definitely not take the boosters. But in the interim, the Pfizer moved to dismiss the case. The court initially dismissed, but then granted the right to amend the case after reconsideration, recognizing that there should be some fraud theory available to us to allege. We're going to go through a second round of motions to dismiss soon. But the core issue that Justice Thomas identified years ago is that the essence of the bargain is what should be evaluated in any QI-TAM or False Claims Act claim. Anytime the argument is that, in this case, Pfizer took billions of dollars from the American taxpayers to put out this product. And what they said, what they had to say by the nature and terms of the contract, was they had to deliver a safe, effective vaccine for the prevention of COVID-19. And the definition of vaccine at that time in the federal contracts and law was something that actually prevented the transmission of COVID-19. What they delivered was not safe, was not effective, was not a vaccine under traditional rules, and did not meet did not prevent any transmission of COVID-19. So the four things they were supposed to do as part of the essence of the bargain, they did not do, and they know they did not do. And so the judge allowed us to come up with different theories or interpretations of how the fraud was done. Was it done by express, false statements in an invoice, certification in the document? Or as Werner explained it to the court, it was really fraud in the inducement of the payment, and that there were multiple acts of that fraud. And we recently filed an extended amended complaint detailing how Pfizer committed that fraud.
Thank you so much. Can you explain a little bit more the nature? So a little bit more in detail, they knew that this was a fraud? Do we have evidence? Have you submitted evidence that they knew that they were perpetrating a fraud on the U.S. population, on our taxpayers?
Go ahead, Warner.
I can go into this a little bit. I mean, this case boils down to something that I think everyone can understand. It's very simple. They had a requirement to provide adequate data to the FDA in order to get this approval. And that adequate data had to be based on well-controlled trials. And Brooke comes in and shows us that the trials were a train wreck. They were not well-controlled. And that makes the data unreliable. So the data is not adequate. People need to remember that this entire program is based on just 170 people that Pfizer describes as endpoints. I think all of us can understand you do not inject or test this product on billions of people relying on just 170. And then when the trial is not controlled, even those 170, some of them should have been knocked out because they were at sites that were unreliable, such as the site that Brooke participated at.
So I see in your second amended complaint in this federal court, district court in Texas, that this case is now called U.S. Versus Ventavia. Has the U.S. position changed in this? And if you can explain what a relator is to us in this False Claims Act case.
Every person in the United States, basically, who knows of fraud against the American taxpayer can bring a case. So you're called a relator. So it's United States XREL Brooke Jackson as the relator. But she is standing in the shoes of all taxpayers of the United States to recover funds that obviously we believe are based on fraud.
So Robert, you mentioned that we expect in this case motions to dismiss coming up. Tell us where this is in the process and what do we see ahead in the case right now?
So the second amended complaint was just filed. It was filed with the permission of the court, and the court granted it. So now the Pfizer's on the clock to file their motion to dismiss. We've preserved all of our prior theories of fraud, but the primary one here is fraud in the inducement. The evidence for fraud in the inducement is that at every single stage of the process, Pfizer knew they were and had information they materially withheld from the American people, the American taxpayer, and the American government. And that includes going all the way back to ivermectin and everything else. I mean, Pfizer kind of went a little bit ballistic at the last court hearing because we noted in our amended complaint, in the draft amended complaint before it was formally and fully filed, that Pfizer did things to allow them to get emergency use authorization that they knew factually they were not entitled to, including suppressing information concerning the effectiveness of ivermectin as a potential therapeutic for COVID-19. It was just one of the many things. I mean, basically, from the get-go, Pfizer was telling the American people and the American government that they could deliver a safe, effective vaccine for the prevention of COVID-19 using mRNA technology, that they could do so at speed and scale at a level that had never been done before for a coronavirus, when they knew internally that, in fact, they couldn't do that. They couldn't deliver anything that was safe. They couldn't deliver anything that was effective. They couldn't deliver a vaccine, and they couldn't deliver something for the prevention of COVID-19. But also they knew there were alternatives available that would completely negate the need or their ability to get an emergency use authorization, since the emergency use authorization law required there be nothing available as an alternative treatment before the vaccine could even be authorized. So that's why they committed fraud at every single level, fraud to get the contract, fraud to get the emergency use authorization, and then fraud to get the payment. And they keep committing the fraud, because they've known now all along that they lied to the American people. They lied to the American taxpayer. They've caused all kinds of illness and injury at a record-setting rate with this so-called vaccine that wasn't a vaccine. And they didn't prevent anything. In fact, of course, now we're seeing evidence from a wide range of clinical surveys and studies, part of the second amended complaint, that show that they were aware that it was completely ineffective very early on. They knew it because their clinical studies were a complete crock. To get people an idea, what Brooke Jackson witnessed was these clinical studies were so bad. You could see people's private medical information plastered on the walls. You could see there were needles sticking out of bags. if they don't have that elemental level of safety, you can't trust anything with these clinical studies. They knew that. They just lied about it. And now the question is consequence. They're going to move to dismiss. We're going to oppose the motion to dismiss. And we are hopeful that the court allows this case to get to discovery, which Pfizer is terrified of allowing to occur because they know we'll discover even more damning evidence of the fraud they committed here.
So explain to us, if you would, on what basis can the defendants here, Ventavia, Pfizer, ICANN, on what basis do you expect them to move to dismiss this case? What is their claim why this shouldn't go forward?
Well, I can explain that if you'd like. They have an argument that it's based on the totality of the circumstances and that basically Brooks' site is too small and too insignificant to affect this. But everyone needs to remember there's only 170 people that Pfizer calls endpoints. You only need to move the needle by a few people. And then that data that they relied on, that they said they needed statistically, falls apart completely, even under their interpretation of the data, which I don't agree with how they did this data analysis anyway. But even under their own goals, guidelines, and data analysis, they would fail based on what Brooke has found.
So let's assume for the moment that you get past this motion to dismiss and you get into discovery. Tell us what you think that looks like. Discovery is one of the great advantages to the system that we have in the United States. What would that look like? What you mentioned, Robert, you think it would be more damning information, but give us a little color into what kind of evidence you'd be able to get, what kind of witnesses you'd be able to depose. What would that really look like going forward, you think?
Okay, go ahead, Warner.
Well, I think it would be a fascinating project because we already have pretty good indication that there are problems at many, many other trial sites. So what that does is everything that Brooke found at her site, I think it is that and worse at other sites. And, you know, we have indications of that. Other people have stepped forward and told us what's out there. So we kind of have a little bit of foresight into what that would look like. And it's everything that I've learned through this case, through this process, everything, every day, it gets worse and worse. It's not like we look at another site and it's better than what Brooke saw. It may be much worse. So that's what I would expect to find. And then the other thing I think that'll be incredibly important is to see what Pfizer's internal communications were like. That's really going to show that they knew this was an unsafe, very risky drug that they developed and that they're having injected in people.
Now, we know from Operation Warp Speed that the president announced at the start of the pandemic that the Department of Defense was actually overseeing Operation Warp Speed. Where does DOD fit into this case, or does it fit into this case in any way?
Well, it does to a degree in the sense that they're the payers. They're the ones writing. They did the contract. They're the ones who wrote the checks. And in this particular context, what the Defense Department contract required was not only that they comply with all the rules and regulations, because what they originally said was, we don't have to impose our own DOD regulations on you because you agree you're going to abide by the FDA regulations. You agree you're going to abide by, you know, the ethics and customs and norms of your industry. But what they also did was they kept saying, what you're going to deliver to us is this. And that is a safe, effective vaccine for the prevention of COVID-19. They weren't seeking a therapeutic. They weren't seeking a diagnostic tool. They made clear what we want, what we need, what you are going to give us is a safe, effective vaccine for the prevention of COVID-19. So this goes beyond even what the emergency use authorization provided, which said maybe it's safe, maybe it's effective. What the contract compelled is that it would be safe, that it would be effective, that that's what was delivered. Payment was predicated upon it being safe, effective, for a vaccine for the prevention of COVID-19. So that's the primary role, is that they were the payer and they were the ones who wrote the contract that imposed those terms on Pfizer.
Let me ask a question. So in a case that Children's Health Defense has supported in New York State, there was a decision by a trial court, New York State court judge, that the mandate of COVID shots for healthcare workers was arbitrary and capricious because it didn't stop transmission. And that case stands. The appeals court said that the case was moot because the state had actually rescinded the mandate for healthcare workers. But does that decision that a vaccine, so-called, that doesn't stop transmission cannot be mandated, does that have any relevance to this case here in federal court in Texas?
Well, I mean, I believe so. It just, everything we're saying is that this is not an effective product whatsoever. So because of that, and Pfizer knew it, they had the clinical trial data. If you look at the 30,000 foot view of their overall data, it's just not there. There's no evidence of statistically significant that shows this is an effective product to prevent transmission that would work in any kind of traditional understanding of quote unquote vaccine. So I think that case does have an impact. The other thing that everyone, has forgotten in this whole process that we're fighting in other cases as well, Mary, is just this whole idea of informed consent. You know, there wasn't informed consent in the trials. The product is still an investigational new drug. It's under emergency use, and there should be informed consent, which means everyone has the option to not take it without any consequences. So those consequences have been horrendous for millions of people who decided that based on their informed consent, they wanted nothing to do with this, and then they got fired. So that's a whole other problem that we have in society that we've got to address.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more about that, Warner, that all of this whole process completely violated the Nuremberg principles, that the consent of the individual is absolutely essential, absolutely necessary. And this was experimental. So one of the things we're observing that seems to be very positive news is that people are not going to get the boosters, right? And that actually Pfizer seems to be in some economic trouble at this point, that their stock price has gone down dramatically in recent months. Can any of you speak to that? What you see, how is that related in any way?
I think you're going to see some securities class actions brought by Pfizer stockholders because Pfizer lied to them. Because if you look at the value of Pfizer stock, same with Moderna, you look at the value of their stock at the time they were promising this wonder drug was going to produce all of these profits when they knew, in fact, it was not going to produce these profits because they knew it wasn't really safe and effective. But ultimately, it's credit to Brooke Jackson bringing this case because the American people got increasingly educated thanks to Children's Health Defense bringing the cases they have, because we went from a place where 98% of people were talking about getting these shots into perpetuity to where now only 2% are even considering getting the shots. That happens because Children's Health Defense and people like Brooke Jackson make the world aware of how dangerous and ineffective this drug actually was.
Wow. Do we have evidence that that's 2%, Robin? Robert, that's pretty extraordinary.
That's according to the government's own most recent data, that the new COVID shots only have 2% uptake.
Wow. That is a big turnaround. Well, is there anything else you want to tell our viewers? And then we're going to move to the scientists to tell us really on a science basis what's going on with all of this malfeasance. Anything else that our viewers should know, things they can do to help? Warner?
Well, I look forward to hearing from the scientists. I know they've looked at the production of this shot and the problems there. And like I said, everybody listening, it only gets worse from here. Yeah. In terms of what Pfizer's done and what's going on.
Well, thank you, Warner. Robert, any parting words from you?
No, just thanks to all the people at Children's Health Defense to continue to be active in this arena, that it doesn't matter what, we may not always get the immediate success that we often deserve in the courtroom, but we're going to continue fighting in that courtroom. But everybody out there fighting in the court of public opinion, your actions make a difference because it leads to do what Brooke Jackson did here, which has already saved lives, millions of lives around the world. So never underestimate the power of what every single voice can do in this arena.
Robert, thank you so much. And I think the tagline in your second amended complaint and for this show is Pfizer lied and people died. This is not just about the money. This is about the people who are injured and the people who are died. And CHDTV on the bus is recording those really horrific stories of injury and death that are still being excluded from the mainstream, but they're coming. they're absolutely coming. And so thank you both, Robert and Warner, so much for all you're doing. And now we'll bring on the two scientists, Jessica Rose and Josh Gutsko, who will really help us better understand at a scientific level what are the really serious problems with these mRNA shots in particular. So welcome, Jessica and Josh. So great to have you here.
Thank you.
So Jessica, let's start with you. I know you're going to have to leave a little bit early. Tell us what you've learned about the contamination that has been found in these Pfizer vials.
All right. So the gist of it is that Kevin McKernan, who's a genomics expert, quite by accident, he didn't set out to do this, discovered DNA, residual DNA in, first of all, the bivalent Pfizer product, and then he started checking Moderna, the monovalent products, even looked at Janssen. And he discovered residual DNA at very high levels, as a matter of fact, levels that are above EMA standards. I've known about this for a long time because Kevin and I are, you know, we're back and forthing on all subject matter related to this COVID stuff. So it's been quite a while that he's been, you know, ringing the bell about this. And since then, his work has been reproduced. And this is very important because one person can say, I found this disastrous finding. And if nobody reproduces it, then, you know, and Kevin's the first to say this, it's not worth its weight in gold if it's not reproducible. So it has been reproduced in many labs, international labs. One of the first people to also ring the bell is an oncologist named Philip Buchholz, and he actually set out to prove Kevin wrong. And he was quite astounded to find out that he, you know, there was a lot of DNA in both of the vials that he tested. So this is bad because for people who don't realize what I'm talking about here, DNA is absolutely not supposed to be in these products. These are modified mRNA products. And Josh is going to talk a little bit about you know, the debacle that happened. But basically, the products that were injected into billions of people were called process 2. And the modified mRNA that was made in the process 2 manufacturing process used a different system. The DNA was produced in a different way as for the clinical trial participant modified mRNA. So they're not the same things. The things that went into the clinical trial participants, the products, are not the same products that went into the billions of people. And the reason why this is problematic is because of this issue. It's a plasmid E. coli system that they use to grow up, quote unquote.
What does that mean, Jess? Explain to us what a plasmid E. coli system is, would you?
Yes. So the DNA that was used to produce the modified mRNA for the process 1, which Josh will talk about for the clinical trials, was made using PCR. So there's no relevance to any E. coli or DNA contaminant from that realm. So the E. coli plasmid system is taking a circular plasmid of DNA with a spike gene in it and inserting it, for lack of a better word, into an E. coli bacteria, and then giving the E. coli bacteria lots of food and warmth and love and shaking and growing that bacteria up so that every time it doubles, every 20 minutes, it's taking that DNA with it. So at the end, you have tons of DNA, which is really good when you need to upscale a product, if you know what I mean. And so this was the cheap, fast way to make a lot of DNA to make the modified DNA product for use in the Moderna and the Pfizer products that were going to be injected into all the billions of people. The problem was that at the end of the synthesis process of the modified mRNA, apparently the residual DNA from the plasmids that were used to, you know, make this modified mRNA was not cleaned out properly. So we use an enzyme called DNAs to chop up the DNA, the residual DNA, and then it's filtered out. So we're not supposed to have any relatively high levels of DNA. at the end of the purification process of the mRNA or the modified mRNA in this case. And another problem is the potential for lipopolysaccharide contamination, which is a byproduct of using E. coli as a plasmid E. coli system for generating a lot of DNA. This is an endotoxin. We remove this at the end of the process that ever uses this system. We test for endotoxin levels in the final product, because if you inject endotoxin into a person as part of a product, you can kill them. What usually happens is they get anaphylaxis. And one of the adverse events that we've heard a lot of reporting on is anaphylaxis. And a lot of people are thinking, well, that's probably an allergy to polyethylene glycol, which is a component lipid on the lipid nanoparticles. But it's possible, we don't know this yet, it's possible that this is endotoxin left over from this manufacturing process that was used.
Jessica, so let me ask a question. Thank you so much for explaining this to us. Let me ask a question, though. So in theory, would it have been possible to do this process with the DNA from the E. coli, but to purify it? So would it have been possible, if it had been done properly, to get rid of the endotoxin and to get rid of the DNA?
It's a really good question, actually, because you guys probably know that the mRNA was modified in a specific way to swap out the uridines they use with something called N1-methyl pseudouridine. And this guy, this guy, has a property whereby it's really sticky. And it's basically what that means is they need to have a very high temperature to unstick them. So because it has this property, and because it was as part of the endpoint of this manufacturing process, it's possible that DNA and RNA hybrids formed, and they were really stuck together really hard. So that's a possible reason why this DNA is the enzyme that comes to chop up the DNA didn't do a really good job. So those hybrids might have actually been carried along with the modified mRNA in the sacs for packaging into the lipid nanoparticles. We don't know for sure, but I will throw in that the last stage of this mRNA synthesis process is the most expensive. It costs a lot of money to purify the end product, which is the modified mRNA. So it's possible, based on what I've heard of all the sketcherama going on, that they just kind of maybe didn't do due diligence. But they're also supposed to check the DNA levels. So then the question comes down to, well, did they do that? And how often did they actually, the EMA, for example, find that the DNA levels were above the acceptable thresholds? So I also know that a couple of times that happened. So it seems to me that they kind of did know, but maybe they didn't understand why. But nonetheless, I mean, when an issue like this becomes an issue, even after you've injected it into billions of people, you have to do something about it, because there's all sorts of possible things that can go wrong in terms of integration now, which we were also explicitly told would never be an issue with these products.
Thank you. We've heard a little bit about, I think, from Dr. Buchholz and from Dr. McKernan about simian virus 40 that's been found, a cancer promoter. Could you tell us a little bit about that? And then we'll hear from Josh.
Yeah. So some of this DNA, this is very important, actually. Pfizer disclosed a plasmid map that they claim to have used, which had a certain antibiotic resistance gene, the spike gene, a T7 promoter, and some origin of replication. The actual plasmid that came out of Kevin's sequencing had something called an SV40 promoter, which is simian virus 40 promoter, and an enhancer, which is something that enhances transcription, which is the SV40 promoter starts transcription. and also an additional antibiotic resistance gene. So there's a difference between the disclosed plasmid map from Pfizer and what was actually found. So that's really, really good, because that's hiding something of great importance because of the nature of SV40. So this is a very strong promoter. It doesn't need to be there, which is probably the most, the thing that makes me go, the most. It's not, it doesn't need to be there in the E. coli system for that system to work. So it's very,
So we have to get to the bottom of this, right, Jess? This is really a really serious question. So Josh, over to you. I read that you talk about the bait and switch. Would you explain to us what the bait and switch is?
Okay, sure. So as Jessica said, the vaccine, the product that was used in the clinical trials, is a very different product from the product that was rolled out to billions of people around the world and injected into billions of arms around the world. And she went into some detail describing some of the differences between that. You have the DNA contamination, you have the endotoxin, there's also concerns among the regulators about the mRNA integrity. So the regulators were aware of this, but we weren't, right? And a bait and switch is this idea where somebody wants to sell you something, advertises this wonderful product, right? And you could think of the Pfizer BioNTech clinical trials, a kind of advertisement, right? Well, we've got this wonderful, effective, safe product. Then you go in to get it. Well, it turns out that they don't have that anymore, but they've got this other product that they're going to give you that's just as good and just as safe and just as this. So that's a classic kind of bait and switch descriptional bait and switch. The difference here, of course, is that nobody was told. It didn't matter how much you followed all of the FDA meetings, all of the publications, everything. You could follow it inside out and know every last detail, but people were not made aware of the fact that this was a totally different product. So how did the regulators let Pfizer get away with this? Because they knew it was a different product, and they had Pfizer show them all of these different comparisons between the two products. Incidentally, they did look at the amount of residual DNA that was in the shot. However, they used a method that essentially misses small pieces of DNA. And what's been found now is that most of the DNA that's in this is in small sequences. And so all of that was basically missed by the type of method that Pfizer used to look at this. And all of the regulations and all of the tests that have been developed to look at any of this, whether it's the endotoxin or the DNA, are all based on old technology. They don't take into account the fact that the DNA and the endotoxin can be encapsulated in the liquid nanoparticles so that it wouldn't even be detected on any of these tests. Not only that, it would enhance the toxicity of them because it takes them and puts them right into your cell and even possibly into your nucleus.
Okay. John, I think you said that these two processes, process one and process two, are radically different. Explain to us a little bit more in layperson's terms. How are they radically different? I understand that things can be camouflaged, but explain a little bit more why this is such a serious fraud, or appears to be.
Well, you're taking, okay, so Jessica mentioned this, the first ones were made with PCR. You need a DNA template in order to make mRNA. Okay, so the first, in order to have a template to make enough mRNA, you need a lot of DNA. So the first process one, they used PCR, right? Which basically just replicates any DNA sequence that you give it. Okay, that's what it's made for. They use it for diagnostic testing and whatever, but it's basically just, it creates DNA, okay? Or some kind of, nucleic acids, all right. And then you can then create the mRNA, and then any residual impurities, they use this very thorough magnetic bead system to clean it out. Now, this process two, they use E. coli bacteria, right? E. coli, that's not good for, generally not good for us. It's in our excrement. And they put plasmids DNA template in there, and then they grew it by replicating the bacteria. Okay, that's the DNA template. They cut it up, they lay it out, and then they make mRNA with it. Then they have to clean all of that stuff out, and they just didn't do, not only did they not do a good job at it, but it's really unclear how well they would be able to. Probably the DNA they could get out if they really tried, but the endotoxin from the E. coli, endotoxins are basically the membranes of the E. coli bacteria, okay? They're highly toxic, highly inflammatory, and it's really unclear how well they could actually clean that out in a way that's scalable, okay? In a way that's scalable. Also, the methods they use to measure how much endotoxin is in there is very unreliable, and I could get into that. But so those are that's kind of like the key differences between them. There were also changes made, by the way, to the way the LNPs were manufactured. So it's just this huge shift, right? And they never, so the regulators only wanted to see these sort of analytical comparisons using tests. They never made them, as far as we know, okay, as far as we know, they never asked to see animal studies with this new product, okay? And the only thing that Pfizer did was they said, okay, we're going, they made a change to their research protocol in early October 2020. They said, we're going to test this new process. Back the you know, doses made with this new process on 250 people per lot of this process to these process two doses. They never said how many lots they were going to test. And they also said, we're only going to test it on people between the ages of 16 and 55. What, why only up until 55? Wasn't this vaccine supposed to be for really to protect the elderly? And then why aren't you testing this new process on older groups? Now, they never said how many lots they were going to test, but we have the data. We have the clinical data, and we can go in and we can identify who was given those process two doses. And what we found is that they only tested one lot on 252 people. Yes, you heard me correct. They had 252 people. They told us they tested it on 22,000, but in fact, what they put in your arm was only tested on 252 people. Now, they said in that protocol that they were going to compare the safety and the immunogenicity of this new product. They're going to compare that to 250 of the people who got the clinical trial process one doses and do a comparison. Now we know through Freedom of Information Act request that they never did that study. They never did a comparison, and the regulators never required them. I mean, the comparison is bogus anyway. 250 people, you're not really going to see anything. Although actually, because we have the data, we can do the comparison. And, you know, so immunogenicity is, to what extent does this create a immune response, antibody response? They only tested four people, all of them under the age of 23, and they only found an immune response in three out of four of the people, an antibody response in three out of four of the people they tested.
Josh, thank you. This is so shocking.
Let me just say this one quickly.
Yeah, I'll just put it in questions.
250 doses to the safety profile of all of the other people who got, you know, in the treatment group. And that these 250 people had 2.5 times the rate of adverse events as all of the other treatment subjects. So based on what we can see, it was not as effective and not as safe, you know, if the original doses were, you know, I don't want to say that the original recipe was wonderful and totally safe and everything. But when you see, you know, just a couple of weeks ago, there was a study that came out in Science Advances that showed that about 7.5% of premenstrual women had vaginal bleeding after vaccination with the mRNA, you know, with the Pfizer doses. 7.5% had vaginal bleeding within 4 weeks. You know what the percentage was in the clinical trials? It was 0.7%, not 7%. And so how do you get this big difference? Well, one way you get it is Pfizer isn't doing a good job of tracking their adverse events, which we know is also true. But the other thing is they've given us a different product. And so now you come out, you know, and when the jabs first came out and they were getting anaphylaxis and this and that, and people were reporting that, like, well, that can't possibly be related because we didn't see it in the trial. Well, the reason you didn't see it in the trial is because you're putting something else completely different in people's arms.
Thank you.
Without telling them.
Yeah, no, this is a total bait and switch, total lack of informed consent. Jessica, before you have to leave, any final words from you?
Josh, well said. You said most of my points. But I just want to round off the, like, something that will resonate with Werner and Robert and Josh and all of you guys here. The point here is there's no possibility of informed consent here, because exactly what Josh said, this is a different product that went in. It's absolutely something that should have had its own clinical trial because it was so different. And furthermore, these acute adverse event reports, which are the ones we've seen within the last 2 years, you know, and extending into chronic, are quite likely, let's just say potentially, you know, to give them some lenience here, due to the DNA, residual DNA, and the LPS contaminant, if it's there. So two more things. There's a lot of adverse events that could arise in the future as a result of problems with genomic instability or insertional mutagenesis on the subject of integration. And I hate to leave it there, but there's a lot more to talk about. And also, I mean, yeah, anyway, I'll leave it there. There's a lot more coming with this. And the only thing we can do now is ring our bells as loud as we can, because this literally affects all of us. Literally.
Yeah. Thank you, Jess. So Josh, you've written in your Twitter feed about a Danish study that seems to suggest that there are three different, basically, effects of these shots. Tell us why that's relevant and what that's about.
Well, there was a Danish study that looked at different lots that were distributed in Denmark. And they looked at the adverse events that had been reported for those different lots. And they found kind of like three different sets of lots that had sort of three different safety profiles. One that had almost no adverse events, and one that had sort of a medium amount, and one that had a lot. So what they tried to control for the number of people that had been given the lots and the timing of the lots. I mean, there's still some open questions about the research. It's certainly not the final word, but it's very suggestive evidence of very high variability in the safety of the lots. And this is probably not going to be news to many of your listeners, but I think it's fair to say that this new process that they chose, right, opens the door for a wider, much wider variability in terms of the safety of the vaccine.
Right. Josh, thank you so much. Any final words from you? We're going to then move over to talk about our California chapter. But any final thoughts?
No, I think I covered everything that I wanted to get across. Thank you for having me.
I mean, the takeaway for me is this is an extraordinary bait and switch.
Okay, here's something I want to say. You were talking earlier about informed consent, right? So what this means is that no matter how much you knew about what was going on with these, with the trials and the results and everything, nobody could have given their informed consent, even if they were under no duress whatsoever. Nobody could have given informed consent because nobody was informed about this major, major change to the way that the vaccines were manufactured and the fact that they were basically getting a different product.
Thank you so much, Josh, for making that so crystal clear that literally it was impossible for the billions of people who got these shots to have given informed consent. And that violates the most fundamental human rights principles that we have since the late 1940s.